My first tip conventionally, and I had thought of this rather late today, was to get the person who's introducing you to say nice things about you. But because the rub is that you have to tell them right, otherwise they give you credit for speaking 18 languages and working in 80 countries. In fact, my books are in all those languages and they're in all those countries, and it's one of those really boring things that when I go on the expensive holiday somewhere a long way from home, I have to find a bookshop, which, in, I have to say, in places like Addis Ababa is quite a challenge. There's one bookshop in Addis Ababa, and yes, there was my book in there, and I was like happy for the rest of the time. I didn't need to do anything else in East Africa apart from find my book, so I'm a little bit sad like that. The other thing I'd say is that I think that we're in a very interesting sort of time and era in the world and in the country, and whatever your view on big society, the phrase and the way it's interpreted by different people, and it's a little heart thingy at the bottom there, that's cool, yeah, I've sort of forgot that. It's kind of here to stay, and so the barefoot bit is about being in touch and connected and feeling a way about and feeling a little bit vulnerable and perhaps uncomfortable, because I think it's all about doing things we haven't done before. So my sort of, what I'd like you to do, encourage you to do, and this is a bit of a test of geography for me, is to sort of take your shoes and socks off, because it's air conditioned and it won't smell. And the number of you that do it, I can tell you, is an interesting indicator, a social indicator. So it's like one of my sort of experiments. I can tell you that in Redcar, it didn't go down very well at all. And we had curry and chips for lunch, and that was Redcar. But anywhere south of Leeds, people are normally pretty good about sort of removing things. And I think if you get nearer to Brighton you get, it's hard to stop them when they've just taken off their shoes and socks. It's also quite delightful and to come to an event like this and think of a theme with a story. And I thought, well, I'll be ridiculous and think about Mr. Mannering, because I quite like that whole Dad's Army thing. And look around and read the badge of the guy next to me and find his name is Frank and he comes from Berlin. So I promise I won't talk about the war, okay? Should have got a laugh there, didn't I? Okay. Very risky. Because I like sort of metaphor. And lots of people describe big society as being like Dad's Army, you know, the bunch of sort of hapless amateurs bumbling along and doing what they're doing. And it's not necessarily, I'm not in the road, I'm in front of the screen, aren't I? I've been dazzled by something. Am I all right? Would you like me here, or would you like me where you can't see the screen? Choice. You can go from here upwards, yeah, but the feet stay the same. Okay. I'm worried about that little hourglass thing. So different perspectives on big society. Yeah? Andrew Mawson here was a congregational minister who went to an East End church as their like vicar guy. And it was a massive church the size of a barn. It had seven old ladies who were determined to secure their place in heaven. It had no money in the bank and it was all like desolate. And surrounded, it was like an oasis of calm, surrounded by everything you could imagine in terms of urban deprivation. Andrew Mawson changed all that by making the church the place where stuff happened. He made it a thriving social enterprise. And in a way, he was one of the precursors to what they call big society today. He saw an opportunity, he did something, it happened, he changed it, and away he went. And his sort of phrase here sort of fits me, with me with that, a bit with that sort of Dad's Army thing about don't miss the opportunity presented by a good crisis. And of course, Captain Mannering always missed the opportunity presented by every crisis because he had in fact created every crisis. And there it went. And although we're in a university sort of city, town, place, and a lot of you guys will have PhDs and things that I couldn't imagine ever having myself, I think that actually ignorance and confidence can take you a long, long way. Certainly in my case, substitute for lack of academic achievement. By the end of the session, you'll either agree with me or you'll be really pleased that you have whatever you have hanging on your office wall. But when people tell me that that big society is like Dad's Army, those bumbling, fumbling amateurs, I say, no, it's more like the Land Army. Because the Land Army actually was around at the same time as Dad's Army in the Second World War. It was well organised. It was about people doing things that were healthy and happy and outdoors. They were very fit. It was growing food and local food, which is a big, big issue right now. And of course, it was about sustainability, about not being reliant on food being imported from other parts of the world where somebody else was tending to sink the shipping. And so if you see, I tend to see big society and doing this stuff very much more like the Land Army than Dad's Army. It's one of the things I write about that people sort of pick up and quote. And if you're going to read a book about big society, apart from any book that I've written, I'd say that The Red Tory by Philip Blond is the one to go for. Flip Braun's a really interesting guy. Any of you here heard him speak or seen him speak? Yeah, he's rather like, he looks and sounds a bit like Stephen Fry. He's got brain size of a planet. He's not married. And he has a funny haircut, yeah? But he hasn't got 2.5 million Twitter followers. But he does think, what he says is that the future is social enterprise. The future are enterprises that have a strong social purpose as well as a profit motive and actually don't wreck the environment. And my view is that they will come from places like what you're doing rather than what we might call a social enterprise today. And I'll come to that later. So for me, the opportunity is for people that don't see themselves as being social entrepreneurs to sort of see the opportunity that space presents and move into it. I met this guy last Tuesday, Nat Way, at the House of Lords. He's 34 years old, so to me, irritatingly young, and irritatingly bright, and irritatingly successful, and irritatingly close to all the people that I'd like to be able to influence. Or he was until 36 hours ago. And this experience he had in February, he just resigned, by the way, as the big society sort of czar, advisor to Cameron, and it's caused lots of furore in the press and lots of stick. And he's actually migrating to do some unpaid work with the Community Foundations Network that I do some work with. And so, interestingly, I was with Nat Way last week when he wasn't telling me he was leaving. And then yesterday I was with the people that he's going to work with who are telling me the other side of the story. But he took this job working in the House of Lords. So he took the red robe and that. And he gave up a £100,000 a year job to do the thing for nothing. And the reason he did it for nothing was because the government have a quota for the number of paid advisors they have, and they were at quota. And I think the mistake he made was he took that as, that's okay, there's a rule there, we'll stick with it. Now, I think that to pay him £100,000 a year to do a good job as an advisor of the government, compared to the cost of the odd missile that we might hurl at Tripoli or somewhere, is actually quite small. And there doesn't seem to be a thing with the forces where they say, actually, we've spent our budget for missiles this month. We can't bomb anybody else. Or the hospital says, well, we've spent our budget for heart surgery, so we'll leave that one in the ambulance and send them back again. So I would have challenged that rule and potentially had I been him, still been there. But what drives him, and the reason why he's not a multimillionaire partner of McKinsey, because he clearly could have been, he was working with them before he went to the House of Lords, was that he was passionate about doing something for society. He was passionate about changing the world in which he lives, overcoming some of the injustices that he sees as somebody who grew up in an ethnic minority in a fairly poor part of Milton Keynes, with Chinese parents, immigrant parents, and who has a track record of success at changing those things as a social entrepreneur. And I think increasingly we're getting to a point where people are recognising that bling is no longer king. That it's not about having more of all those nice, expensive, consumery things that the advertisers tell us we should have. It's about feeling good about ourselves and the things that we do. And that isn't about being on some sort of evangelical journey of enlightenment, although I have likened big society to Buddhism in that sort of way, you know, from within and out. But it's very much about feeling that you're part of a community and that community being really important to you. And I read recently a book by Robin Dunbar, who to me is like, he's like the Brian Cox of anthropology, but he hasn't been on telly yet. And he talks about this Dunbar number, where there's like 150 people is what we're comfy with. And we go beyond that and we break away. So if you go back a few 100,000 years, every time you got to about over 150 people in a group, a pack of humans, a tribe, whatever, some of the young bloods would get a bit grumpy, fight each other, grab a couple of girls, drag them off and start somewhere else. And that's kind of how we spread. And so you wonder, why is it then that we have problems when we get 5,000 people, put them in three tower blocks between a canal, a motorway and a railway line? And all this stuff is about getting it down into small manageable chunks again. And arguably technology is a really good way of doing that. But then you get these sort of practical issues, and I use this slide quite a bit when I'm talking to groups of councils and things, that everybody talks about big society, but actually do people give a shit about what happens in their neighbourhood? And if you read that, that's somebody bemoaning the fact that nothing happened. Everybody was there with their, you know, sky dish and the curtains drawn, watching the telly, throwing the special brew cans out the window into the yard, perhaps, where was the dead car and the upturned pram. But they weren't doing stuff. And how do you get people to do things again? How do you reconnect them with their community and their environment? And if you think about in New York, when I think one of the new guys sort of took over in charge in New York and decided to get rid of graffiti. When you take the graffiti away, you get less graffiti added. If you mend the broken windows, people don't break windows. People tend to be inspired by what they see around them. And if it's devastation and neglect, then they're encouraged to create more of that. So that's quite sobering, but that's sort of the challenge. And that's why I think it's about starting with very small groups of people and not convenient chunks, as government would have us look at. Oh, and if you want to ask me questions as we go along, please do. Otherwise, we'll just run on forever and tell a couple of stories and go for lunch. The other thing I like doing is I like going to places that I find are comfortable and difficult. I like to meet people in government and talk about big society. I like to spend time with journalists at The Guardian and The Times as I do and write stuff that they publish as I do. But I actually like to be right there at the heart of it, right where it's happening. And I'll tell you a little story about Southwold. Do any of you know Southwold in Suffolk? Yeah, a very genteel place. It's like it's classic, you know, middle-class 1950s sort of Britain, really. And most of the people there were alive and kicking in the 1950s, and they're now very, very old. And they're getting a new... The hospital in the town is falling apart. There's a new health development coming on, and there's a plan about having a community-owned nursing home which will contain hospital beds. So the theory is hospital's inefficient, too small, wrong size. Get rid of that. Get a nursing home. Dozen beds for like old creaky people, dozen beds for people with dementia, and a dozen beds which are like NHS funded, and that's for people that would have been in the hospital but won't be there anymore because it'll be turned into something else, yeah? And the model of these things is to get community ownership of these buildings. So if a community own a building, then it sort of works. If a community own a nursing home, they care about it, they volunteer much more, they do much more stuff than if it's just some company coming in like Southern Cross and running it and then going bust and leaving everybody astray. So that was sort of the context. And I ended up in this front room at a meeting of the League of Friends of this hospital. Because the first £1 million we need to build this hospital is in their bank account. Because ever since the hospital was built in about 1922, they've been doing fundraising, saving money, using it to buy things like Christmas decorations, presents for the nurses, and those nice sort of few grand bits of technology that mean that you can get a fix locally rather than making a 35-mile journey to an acute hospital. And it had grown and grown and grown to like this massive big wad of money. And now this hospital's closing, so what do they do with it? And I said, well, actually, wouldn't it be really nice if you used that to name a wing of this new place? And she said, but they stole our hospital in 1948. You know, the public subscription funded the original hospital, and then in 1948 became nationalised. And there are lots of arguments about why that won't happen again. There are lots of arguments about the investment by the government in that community since 1948 was way and above what they'd invested in it before. But actually, to her, that was the risk. And then, of course, there's that sort of Adrian Mole scenario, as I describe it, where people want to measure everything but nothing that matters. And as Adrian Mole found out, you can measure things every day and they don't grow any faster. And yet, I meet lots of people. I work with charities who are in that sort of place where they're doing government contract work, and they actually have to hire somebody, pay somebody, to work in the organisation, to measure the things, to give the data back to the funder who doesn't understand it because their funding is just dependent on them giving that information back up to somebody else further up the line. And then when it comes to contract negotiations, the first thing that is talked about is, well, your overhead's a bit high. Well, yeah, that's because it's cost me £40,000 a year to have somebody sitting in the corner counting things and filling in forms. And you get these loops that go on and on and on. And I think right now is a time when there isn't the money for those loops, there isn't the money for the people just to count the beans and pass the information up the line, because it's about what's happening at the bottom that matters. And of course, the NHS is that sort of classic monolith where whatever it tries to do, it doesn't kind of work. And isn't it terrifying the way they do make decisions based on rumour and myth? And isn't it terrifying the way they set up these PFA hospitals that are costing an absolute mint to support? Which is almost like a multi-local version of the aircraft carrier that the last government commissioned that will never have any use because we haven't got any aircraft to put on it. Isn't that true? And you couldn't cancel it because it would cost too much. And you sort of wonder when those decisions are made on a big level, how did we as citizens allow our democratic process to get to the point where seemingly rational people were making incredibly irrational decisions? And so for me, big society is about grabbing that control back. And this guy Lance, I've met him at a conference, he's in Grimsby, and he's a fantastic bloke, and his argument, rather than us giving people lots of data, was to get into the minutiae of the law and take to court his local council. And they got so pissed off with it, frankly, that they moved the department that he was complaining about into his organisation. He acquired it. So he sort of grew by almost full-on attack, which is kind of nice. I quite like being rude about people when I'm speaking at events, and I'm assuming none of you here work like in the public sector, as in local government and stuff, yeah? Christ, I thought I saw a hand going up. No, I'm okay. But I just want to come back to the Dad's Army analogy, yeah, just gently, with apologies to anybody that might be unsure about that. And, you know, the media, we listen to the media. The media are interpreting and misinterpreting this stuff all the time, yeah? What's their agenda? Their agenda is ad revenues are falling, print prices are rising, the internet is taking over the media. There's lots of free content, they've got lots of expensive journalists. They're in a really tough place. The only way they can sell papers is by being controversial. So who can believe the media? They're, you know, they're stuck there in the hedge trying to peer out. And then, of course, you've got the quangos that tell us they know what they're doing. Isn't that the classic quango? And they're there, aren't they? Unelected, you know, and doing these things, and they disappear. I can think of some organisations that are severely damaged in the parts of the world I work in because quangos have basically messed them up, and those quangos now disappeared. And the irony is the people in the quangos, when the quango disappears, the first place they go looking for a job is the people they screwed up because they kind of know that territory. Bizarre. And then, of course, you've got the traditional charity sector that think it's all about shaking tins, and how dare you suggest we become income generators. And they're out there fighting big time to protect the status quo. And there's going to be a massive shake-up in the charity world, I think, over the next couple of years, because it's been allowed to grow without any real competition, without any real sort of innovation. And there's going to be this massive consolidation and focus, because actually the money in that world is now getting much more down to the level of the individual service user. Now, the old lady will decide whether she wants to go to a lunch club or whether she wants to go to bingo. Do Age UK need to start thinking about whether they want to start doing bingo or make their lunches more interesting? And then, of course, you've got local government. They sort of talk and talk and talk, don't they? I spent some time, half a day actually, with Eric Pickle's department in Whitehall, the Department of Communities and Local Government. And it was a barrier-busting session for senior civil servants, that's what it's called. And we all sort of gathered in this big room at the beginning. And it was really interesting. We all got there and there's coffee and stuff. And then Eric Pickle's came in, sort of waddled in, and told them all to, they were doing a great job and stuff, and how wonderful it all was. And then he waddled off again. The way they sort of almost bowed down to him is interesting. The way they sort of stood back as he came in, that sort of, almost as if he's a sort of royalty or deity. And then when I talked to them, I showed them various images, and I took them back to the Suffolk coast where I was earlier with Southwold. And further down the Suffolk coast, there's a big power station, nuclear power station. Any of you know that? Yeah. And between the power station and the sea, there are a row of big concrete blocks. They're like that sort of square and that sort of height. Do you know why they were put there?
Anti-tank.
Yeah, anti-tanks. And the irony is that we didn't need them after 1945. It's now 2011 and they're still there. And to me, legislation is like that. We create it, but we never take it away. We make rules and cultural rules often, practices within large organisations, particularly in the public sector. In my experience, they're created, they become defunct, but they're never removed. until somebody feels threatened, and then they say, oh, actually, but there's a rule there. There's a concrete block there. We can't move that because. So that's kind of what happens. So for you, I think it's about you becoming more entrepreneurial. And I guess my role today is to encourage you to think in more entrepreneurial ways and to actually apply some entrepreneurial spirit to your environment. And if you're barefoot now, then you might stand a better chance than if you're not. Who knows? Because it's about willingness to experiment. But just the same way that Nat Way had a passion for social change, driven by personal experience as a second-generation Chinese immigrant, that gave him the strength to take on government, and is now giving him the strength to rebel all the negative press that he's experiencing as he takes a well-earned holiday. It's anger that gets people moving and doing things. It's anger that makes people start organisations. Always personal experience. I think I'm right in saying that that Bell, who invented the telephone, had a profoundly deaf wife and a profoundly deaf mother, and he was interested in communication. That personal experience drove him to do that. I think I'm right in saying that, and I always forget who it wasn't Pasteur, but one of his peers who worked in that sort of area, lost 3 children to disease very young. Nothing like that to drive you to think of finding a way to get around that problem. And you could argue that Nelson Mandela could have quite happily had a career as a black lawyer in a minority position in a, the word begins with A, the state, in South Africa as it was, yeah, apartheid state, but he chose to make the sacrifice of going to prison for those years for doing what he did to bring about the change that brought him where he was. So anger's dead important. And I get angry about ignorance, about inequality, about inertia, imposition, and frankly, idiots. I won't say where the idiots are, but the picture of local government is bigger than all the others, yeah, and I do have some problems there sometimes. And I do a lot of work around mental health and a lot of work around prejudice, because I find it really interesting that I can meet somebody who's selling a big issue today, who when he tells me his life story, it mirrors my own, except at a key point, I went one way and he went the other. And I think that what people don't recognise is that equally, they might not have got to that point yet where they're going to go up or down. And so that, you know, ignorance and equality is quite sort of interesting. I was the only person that went to a public meeting in our community where they were talking about where to site a gypsy and traveller place to offer support, and then it got thrown out. I had to keep saying to the council guys, no, I'm here to support it, not against it, because where else are they going to go? What right have these people got to say no? And I love provoking people like that to make them think about it, because then they sort of start to perhaps challenge the way they are. Imposition, I think, is where we've been for forever. There's a big Millennium Foundation-y thing, sort of bunch of money called Unlimited, that make grants to emerging social entrepreneurs, run by a guy called Cliff Pryor, who I've got to know. And he said the problem with all this big society stuff right now is that for 40 years in this country, we've been told what to do. And now we're being told we can do what we like. So it's almost like we're in that cage with the battery hens in the cage, yeah, and now the cage is open. So do we wait and hope the little man will come and put some feed in the trough in front, even though it's cold and cramped, or do we step outside and start looking for things in the grass, which we're kind of not used to doing. But we kind of know from teaching that the grubs in the grass are actually nicer than the stuff that gets put in the tray. And right now we're in a situation, I think, in the whole country where the cage door is open and the birds are like starting to creep out or look around the corner. And so that's a big opportunity too. And I won't mention idiots again because they make me annoyed. And people talk about entrepreneurship and enterprise, and they talk about social enterprise as a panacea. I did some work with a mental health charity in Norwich they wanted to do social enterprise. We got a capital grant to do social enterprise, and they work with people who are coming back into employment from long-term mental ill health. Okay, so they're quite hard people to get into work, and there are various allowances and grants for doing that. And the skill is to get them to stick in work long enough to claim your money, and then hopefully they'll stay employed after that. So I thought, we'll start a social enterprise, we'll start a cafe. And they knew as little about cafes as I know about your subject. I had no idea how to run a cafe, but I thought, we'll open a cafe. So then I said, well, tell you what, let's do it with somebody who knows how to open a cafe. So I found somebody with a bunch of actually juice and smoothie bars on the South Coast who wants to grow his business. And I put the two together. So one had a model that worked as a business model, had a brand, all that stuff, and the other had the capital to fund it. And it was going really sort of kind of okay until one day I turned up and every seat in the cafe that should have had customers in had their service users who were, to be fair, a pretty mixed bunch of people that unless you were brave, you wouldn't want to necessarily be the only person who wasn't one of them in the room, were sticking labels on cups. So they'd used it to create jobs for those people for the day rather than to attract customers and generate revenue. And to me, that was enterprise just as a straightforward process. Whereas entrepreneurship is the attitude. And I always use those images because one is the Berlin Wall, and that's about the attitude that says I'm going to get through this wall because I want to do things to be different in this world. And the other is a cement mixer, and actually cement mixers, of course, help you to build walls. And where you need to be is to look at the processes that you're working around and think of ways that attitude can reconfigure them. You still need to have the robustness and resilience of a wall, but perhaps a wall with holes in, or tunnels, or doors, or windows through which people can pass things that you want, be it the people you're connecting with out in the wider world, or people that might give you money for the things that you do. Ali took me out for dinner last night, which is quite nice, but potentially dangerous, because then you sort of start drinking and stuff and talking, and then you could do some more drinking and some more talking. But actually, he was talking about some of the crowdsourcing stuff around people reading archive material. And I suddenly thought about Facebook and Farmville and these really meaningless, pointless, stupid things that people do, almost obsessively, which to me sound like a fantastic opportunity for people in your world to generate income by giving people stuff that has more value and use and social context than just some dumb game designed by a geek in Seattle. And the other thing, I like parallels, because I mean, there's nothing new. And if you look at fair trade, the growth of fair trade in the UK is phenomenal. And when it first started, it was kind of the beard and sandals cafe owner with the fair trade coffee, or the little shop, wasn't it, in those neighbourhoods where all the liberal voters live, yeah? And everybody has a three-wheel buggy with their kid, and they all buy organic stuff, and they're all very good and like Delia Smith. And now, you know, Starbucks recently announced that all espresso coffee in Starbucks will be fair trade. And the guys with the purists, with those little cafe outlets or the small bit businesses are really complaining about this. It's terrible, it's sacrilege. They're trashing the fair trade brand. But if you go to East Africa and meet somebody who grows coffee, as I have done, where they have, you know, they're sort of 2 acres and they've got everything there, cassava and bananas and stuff that they eat and stuff that they grow, and everything is for themselves apart from the coffee, which is their one cash crop, which traditionally gets bought by quite sort of mercenary-type traders, consolidated, sent to Mombasa and shipped out to Europe or the States. To them, fair trade is fantastic. To them, Starbucks are fantastic. And I just see that the social enterprise as we see it now, if you go out the door now and look for a social enterprise, and you haven't got to go very far, because I think there's one that makes art stuff and pots which is in the next room, That's a good starting point, but it's not the end of the game. The end of the game is just everybody doing this sort of stuff in ways which are sustainable, in their own way. And I think that if we stood here in 10 years' time, in 2011, whatever the beyond 2011, the 2021 theme will be, I don't know. Who knows? But I think you'll see that the whole social economy has made that same transition. That corporate social responsibility has become just part of the furniture. Why should you spend billions advertising your sugared, flavoured water in bottles, Coca-Cola, to people around the world to add value when actually if you do the right things, people will buy your product anyway, just because it becomes natural. Much more sustainable and less manipulative. And there's just stacks of confusion out there in the social enterprise world right now, so don't even go there, frankly. Because a lot of the focus is around structure. But when you talk to people on the street, they want to see enterprises run by their communities. I'm doing some work with the Plunkett Foundation, who are based at Eynsham, is it pronounced, up the road, not far from here, and they have a network of 250 community-owned shops, where a village shop has closed for all the wrong, or usually because somebody's got bored, fed up, tired, can't sell it, run out of money, or whatever. And so the people who live there form an industrial and provident society, sort of a legal structure, a cooperative of a type. They all buy shares, they all put money in, perhaps just 10, 20 quid each. They borrow money, they get grants, they open a shop. The people who work in it are paid and live in that community. The things that are sold in that shop are predominantly produced in that community or sourced because people there want it. And it becomes their shop, the place they go, the place that they buy what they want, and the place where actually people meet each other and you start to get social dialogue and exchange. People know who their neighbours are for the first time sometimes. And there's one I visited recently where in its first year of trade it turned over £200,000. There's a small shop in a village of 800 people. And the shop that it replaced that closed 3 years ago, in its last year, that shop turned over £20,000. So same people, same community, a tenfold increase in turnover by putting ownership within the community rather than within, in that case, a grumpy old couple who bought a shop because they thought it was a cool way to retire. Really kind of interesting. Yeah, and this was my cue to talk about the cafe, which I've talked about earlier. But that's the kind of the choice that these guys have to make is, do they want to be brand? No, are they going to be brands? Are you going to go to Starbucks because Starbucks are doing the right thing? Or are you going to go to the place that looks a bit dodgy you've never heard of, that isn't promoting itself very well? So the next generation of sort of brand evolution, I think, is around this social impact. And those that don't do it will just stay in that place. There's a huge culture of grant addiction in the current charity sector. It's interesting if you think about the Lifeboat Institution. Is totally voluntarily funded. They raise the money themselves from people that care about lifeboats, which is interesting because not many of us go to sea. But most of us will put money in a tin for the lifeboats. Rethink, on the other hand, big national charity based on the South Bank who work with people with severe mental health problems, deliver lots of government contracts. 85% of their income comes from government grant and contract. That's why they're a charity. How do they break away from that? With great difficulty. And the process is that you start off with a grant and then you get another grant. And then the funder says, I want you to do this. I want only to work with green ones, not blue ones. So you start pushing the blue ones away, which is quite prejudice, to work with the green ones. Or worse, you get some paint and put green paint on the blue ones so that they can meet the criteria of the funding you've got. And you take that to its over a few years and you end up losing all sight of where you were going in the first place. And I guess that's true of any funded relationship, isn't it? It has to be quite carefully managed. And as I keep saying, as I say to charities a lot, it's just time to do things differently. The money isn't there anymore, they have to change. You know, they haven't even got that sort of funding methadone. There's like 30 million of transition funding for charities having their funding cut at the moment, and it's really, really difficult for them to find a way to get hold of that. And certainly without it, they're struggling. And it's going back to the community and the people. And quite a few of you have got laptops and to my huge MB iPads and things out in front of you. And that's sort of where it is right now, because it's like you can do it instantly. You could be telling people that you think I'm an idiot or a hero to the whole world right now. There are no secrets. There is no lag, is there, between the event and the event and the reporting. The Osama bin Laden thing was reported by a guy on Twitter, wasn't it, before it went anywhere else, who happened to be there wondering why there are lots of American planes flying over his house at 1 o'clock in the morning. And that sort of empowerment and the way that you can harness that and focus that is really quite powerful. And I guess it's something that you who are working in that sort of area of digital stuff and knowledge stuff can do really, really well. And it doesn't have to be hard work. The kids on the roundabout are actually working a pump to lift water to go into a tank for a village that has a well, and it's funded by a company called One Water, which is like bottled water, like this. But the difference is that rather than this one says Harrogate spring water, which is great for promoting Harrogate as a tourist destination, every time you buy a bottle of their water, one water, something goes towards making things like that happen. So the direct connection between drinking water here and drinking water there. And for me, the exciting bit is that they're not making it boring. There are people that would have designed it so that you had to have electric pumps, then you have to have a generator, then you have to have a fuel supply, and then you have to have an engineer, and then you have to have lots of other things, and then it breaks and you haven't got water. What they've done is made it fun. And it's kind of like that old story that they say about the space race, isn't it, where the Americans spent millions creating a ballpoint pen that works in space, and the Russians took a pencil. And it's like that simple. We've got to use pencils and not try to hide behind the technology to create things that work that we don't sort of need. Because that effort can be used on other things. And I don't think any of this stuff is difficult. So another little story. I guess most of you have heard of Trevor Bayliss, yeah? Yeah? Yep. He invented that wind-up radio. And he did it because he heard a thing on the radio, on TV about AIDS in Africa and about the difficulties people had in communicating public health messages because there was no communications, because there wasn't electricity. So they hadn't got radios. So he went into a workshop and created this thing. And the only reason he did it, it wasn't because he was cleverer than anybody else. It's just because he did it rather than turning the channel over or making a cup of tea or forgetting about it. So the only difference for him between success and failure was that fact that he overcame that innate inertia that we all have to leave it to somebody else and did something about it. I met him a few years ago. I interviewed him for a magazine. It's one of the things I try to do is to get to meet people I want to meet and be paid to do it. It's quite one of the joys of self-employment. And he lives on this island in the Thames that is only accessible by footbridge, and yet he has a car on the patio in front of his house. So it kind of says he's an interesting guy, yeah? He has a swimming pool in what would have been his dining room. So you have to walk along like this from the kitchen to the living room when you go into his house. And wrapped around the living room is a lean-to, and the lean-to is his workshop. So in terms of becoming an innovator, he didn't have to go very far from his sofa. In fact, his sofa to his workshop was like from me to you, just a few feet. But he did it, and that's what's really important. He also said somewhere that only dead fish swim with the tide. So in terms of opportunities, this is the five things that you might care to do before it's too late, really, is that everybody goes with the flow, don't they? Everybody goes with the tide. Everybody follows that one big queue. We all go to the airport and we queue up endlessly to check our stuff in. And somebody comes along and opens another check-in, but we don't dare leave our queue to join the next queue because it might somehow disappear again. Or we might upset the people that we're overtaking. And they must have to plead with us to come out of our queue sometimes, to get into the other one. And it's just, well, why not just go against the trend? And then you get noticed, and then things happen. Because when everybody's changed direction, you've lost that competitive advantage. You've lost the opportunity to be first. And of course, my second point is that it is always worth being at the front of a queue. And I think right now, at the work I'm doing around Big Society, I'm working with a school, for example, who were going to get a new building and then they weren't under the last government's funding scheme. And I said to them, well, you've got a choice. You can be one of 700 head teachers writing a letter of complaint to Michael Gove, or you can be the one out of 700 that does something different. And they said, OK, what's different look like? So we did something different. And the issues were the school's going to be too expensive. The school was going to be in the wrong place. They didn't want to put it. The council were following a process and not thinking about the future. And just by reconfiguring all sorts of aspects to their school and the project, we're now at a point where their county council have agreed to buy a piece of land in the next 3 months upon which a school will be built, money to be found somewhere. And because it's a special needs school for kids that are severely disabled, and because I happen to know that a severely disabled child that needs residential care goes away to a boarding school that costs £200,000 a year. I know that by getting residential accommodation on the site, the money saved by having a charity running a residential unit next to a state school, the money saved will more than cover the capital repayments of the loan they need to build the school. And unbelievably, there are people in a county council now who are actually understanding that and accepting that and making it their own sort of philosophy for life, to do things differently rather than traditional, we'll wait till we get next year's capital settlement and see how we spend it. So the other sort of message in there really is that right now, there's people are more, the people that might have said no to you, to the things you want to do in the past, are actually very, very receptive to you suggesting new things right now. And there's also a point about relationships. I've been doing some work with a disability charity in Hertfordshire. Funding slashed because the council who fund them didn't understand what they did. Present it in a way that they understand it and they start to help you to find a way around it. And a lot of it comes down to like transactional analysis. So you always end up in this sort of parent-child thing. You know, mummy's got the money, daddy's got the money, and the organisation is sort of begging for it. Right now, they haven't got the money. They've got to have the things done. So it's a much more even relationship. And when I'm working between organisations, I'm inevitably trying to sort of keep them on that same level rather than letting them default back to that their sort of traditional state. Sounds a bit complex, but it's fun. Everybody wants to do something different, don't they? Why don't we just do what we know we can do and do it really well? It's always novel to try something different, but actually doing what you're doing now somewhere different is going to be much more interesting. So rather than you going into fields you don't understand, I'd say find people that you can work with who can take you there. Look at new ways of using the stuff that you're working with right now. Look at new applications for the knowledge you've got. Why can't you have Facebook applications that give people access to stuff that they pay to access to enjoy? There's a whole culture about people expect things not to be paid for. And actually, why shouldn't they pay for it? I spent an afternoon with the trustees of Age UK Hertfordshire the other day. And they're an interesting place, 2.5 million turnover, lots of services, lots of staff, less money, lots of passion, lots of enthusiasm, and a fast-growing older population. But their mindset is sort of that. And we had a big debate about how much should an old lady pay, old person pay, for a lunch at a lunch club, at a day centre. And they thought, well, like £3. But the tragedy is that when that sort of philosophy was put in place, those people, the £3 lunch was a big deal. It was a highlight of their week. And they might have a tin of red salmon on Saturday night or on Sunday as their treat, yeah? Now, they have their £3 lunch. They get on the bus and go to the garden centre and blow £3 on a cappuccino and £20 on plants, because actually they're quite well off. So why not charge them £20 for the lunch, £10 for the lunch? Why not add value to it, do different things? So I think people will pay for all the stuff that you have and access to it. And so they should. If I was ever going to do a PhD, it'd be on fish and chips. Because I think of all the things I ever say to any group, the most profound piece of wisdom I can ever impart is that fishermen do not grow potatoes. However many potatoes they throw over the side of their boat, they will not grow into potatoes. Equally, fish do not survive on farms. And yet you bring together a fisherman, a potato farmer, and a man with a retail outlet on High Street with a vat of hot fat, and you have what effectively is our national dish. And so fish and chips only exist because of collaboration. And very rarely do you get, I've met farmers who have fish and chip shops. I've never met a fisherman who grows potatoes. And so I just think it's about trying to find people to work with rather than try to learn the skills or acquire the behaviours or delve into stuff that, frankly, you don't understand. Stick to what you know and find somebody to work with who doesn't know what you know. I did a piece of work a few years ago with, I always have a problem saying this, the English Folk Dance and Song Society, who got a place in the Regent's Park, and it was like a fascinating charity. And they took me into this room, bigger than this, and it was stuffed full of amazing old books and original wax cylinder recordings of that Vaughan Williams had made of folk singing in the 1890s, and I was completely blown away by it. But it was all like there, and there was nobody who was looking at it. And so I ended up, I think it was the, it wasn't the National Trust, the one we spoke to, but one of those big national organisations started to publish books based on the content of this archive. And they paid a royalty to the library. So all of a sudden, the people were, they weren't just waiting for people to come in and look at this stuff. They were, it was going out in books and forms that people could access. And the final point is that you have to take people where they want to go. You have to start where they are. And you mustn't give out mixed messages. Be very clear about what you want to achieve, where you want to go, and what they can do to help you. And I think we see lots of mixed messages out there right now. I think the whole big society reporting is just a myriad of mixed messages. But it just comes back to that basic thing about what do we want to do, what's important to us and the people we care about, and how can we make that happen in a sustainable way that's kind of enjoyable. So, and there's a degree of pain in this. There is always pain. And there is no gain without pain. And you have to leave your comfort zone. You have to do things you find uncomfortable. You have to confront things that you don't like. But actually, the rewards, I think, can be quite great. And I don't think there's ever been a better time than right now to do some of this stuff. I don't think there's ever been a better time for any organisation to think about becoming free of what might be, you know, one line of funding, to involve wider audiences, to get different things happening, because it's like actually now anything can happen. I've been used to work with a village in who are going to have a community shop, and they're going to put it in a church. Because their argument was, well, the church is a nice building, but it's only used for like 2 hours a week. Why not put a shop in it? And they're going to put around the site, they're going to take the pews out, which, believe it or not, is the biggest controversy of all. And then around the outside of the church, inside the outside, right around the walls, will be all the shop displays, the freezers and the stuff. And in the middle will be like cafe tables. Because they only have about 50 people at most in the congregation. So when they have their Sunday morning service, they'll just have the table, the chairs facing the front. And then you can do shopping on the way home. And that's rather cool, isn't it? And yet, 20 years ago, that would have been unimaginable. So the last point before you ask me lots of questions, hopefully, is that now is the time. And clearly, if I can help do that, then I will do it.